Good morning, everyone. I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we will begin with the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam. Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen. I believe she's joining now. I'll give her a second. Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative, I believe Munson is excused. He'll be joining us shortly. Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson. And then I believe Representative Christensen just joined us. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Quorum is present. We have two sets of minutes to approve. The first are the minutes from February 11th, 2021. Representative Akam, have you had a chance to review them?
So I have, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Representative Akam moves approval of the minutes from February 11th, 2021. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. We also have the minutes from February 16th, 2021. Representative Akam, have you reviewed those?
Yes, I have, and I move approval.
Representative Akam moves approval of the minutes from February 16th, 2021. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. Well, members, it is Solar Day in the Climate and Energy Committee, and we will have four bills all dealing with solar. But first, we are going to hear a perspective on the solar industry. And we are joined by Carl von Nobelsdorf. Has Carl rejoined us?
I'm going to be on under Megan Raymaker. My camera won't turn on, so.
Okay, no problem. Mr. von Nobelsdorf, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me. Excited to be here today to give you a little background on myself and our company and what solar in Minnesota has kind of done for us and our people. So my name is Carl von Knobelsdorf. I'm president and CEO of Knobelsdorf Enterprises. We are a renewable contractor, electrical contractor, and an automation and engineering contractor based out of Goodyear, Minnesota. We also have an office up in Eagan as well. So I'm a 2004 graduate of Goodyear High School, went on to farm and ride dirt bikes for a year after high school, and then I came back to work for my dad and got my journeyman's license when I was 19. I got my master's license when I was 20, and then I went on to get my master's license in six other states. Live in rural Goodyear, Minnesota with four children who are actively involved with our business. Our business is located right where I live, so it's kind of fun to see them get involved and at a young age. Currently, we employ over 250 people working across the country doing industrial design, build, electrical work. And a big part of our business that's come over the last 4 years has been solar in Minnesota. So thanks to that CSG program, that's been a big boon for business for us, and it's allowed us to really hire a lot of local people and not only professional office staff, but as well as field craft hands to build these solar farms all over the state. So it's been a great program that, again, allowed us to hire a lot of local people and put them to work and grow the company and provide good paying jobs for our people and also give back to the communities. So one of the things that our company started this past year was we took seven local school districts and were giving them money to help promote the trades and construction in those schools. And if we wanted to have the renewable side of our business, we probably would have not been able to do that. So we also employ a lot of local veterans and hire again, a lot of local people to help build these farms across the state. So it's been a great program, and looking forward to seeing these bills that you guys have in front of you today, and hoping to continue to promote that in Minnesota, and again, allow us to continue to hire local people and provide good quality jobs in the state.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. von Knobelsdorf, for joining us and congratulations on your company's success and growth. It's exciting to hear the work you're doing in the solar industry.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun. So
with that, we will turn to our first bill for today, which is Representative Akam's Solar on Schools bill. Representative Akam, would you like to present your bill?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and fellow members of the Energy or Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. I appreciate the time this morning to present House File 1427, otherwise known as Solar on Schools. And I will have to say the bill was just introduced officially yesterday, and so I wasn't able to introduce any author's amendments, and we'll do that at a later date. This bill is one of those unique opportunities for a win-win scenario. It develops a program that's going to be run through the Minnesota Department of Commerce for school districts to apply to install solar panels on their buildings. As we would expect, the largest expenditure in school districts is teachers, and the second highest budget item is electricity. And given how hard our schools are working to do more with less, especially during the pandemic, wouldn't it be great if they could take the money they are currently spending on electricity and redirect it into the classroom? Those savings could have a real impact on our students. It could be used to lower class sizes. It could ensure kids have more one-on-one instruction. And frankly, it could be used to reduce taxes. Another benefit of solar on schools is that if a school is participating in the program, it will give students and classes the opportunity to learn more about renewable energy firsthand. The meter that shows how much energy is being produced will be placed in the schools, so the information will be available for teachers to use for educational purposes. We have heard many times from testifiers in our committee that green jobs, such as building and installing solar panels, are some of the fastest growing jobs in our state. Giving students the opportunity to learn more about the industry and possible jobs is an added benefit to this program and to the students. As I said earlier, Solar on Schools is really a win-win scenario. I have a few testifiers who will present to the committee. First, I have Pat Collins, a teacher from Chisago Lake Schools.
Mr. Collins, welcome to the committee.
I became one of my students here, muted. Well, we started into this foray into solar in 2008. It really started with a student asking a question, well, why can't we have solar on our school? And so we started digging around into that, and we found out it was really expensive. It was $103,000 for a 10-kilowatt system, and kids said, well, we should do it. And so I went to the school board, and they said, no, that's too much. And then I went back a month later with a bunch of seventh graders, and they convinced the school board that we should do it. And it took us 2 years to raise the money. And by the time we were done, the price was down to $73,000. And they had dances. They sold trees that they potted. They took their gum and threw it into buckets, and the custodians would pay them for a pound of gum rather than picking it up. They did all kinds of stuff. And it was a huge success. We had a wonderful day celebrating it. And then we got a grant a couple years later for to put 40 kilowatts on all of our five schools. And that was such a success that the local solar fields came to us and said, would you consider buying into our solar fields, which our kids drive by every day? And so we have about 15,000 solar panels that the school leases or owns. And we have zero parent complaints. And if you're in a school district, that's a miracle in itself right there. Nobody's complaining about the $3 to $6 million we save over 30 years. No one's complaining about the looks of it because it's on the school. We have dummy panels in front of the schools so kids can touch it. But, you know, people always want to talk about the ROI, and they always want a monetary value. And I sometimes think that's a wonderful way to look at it, because just as Representative Akam said, we can put that money back into schools. But, you know, watching the NASA Perseverance stuff this week, and I see those little boys and girls that are playing with rockets when they're kids, and they end up being the ones that design this. They're the engineers that design this miraculous machine. Well, these kids that come to school every day and walk underneath these panels are the ones saying, well, why can't we do this? Why can't we use this application here? And so the ROI, yeah, there's a huge monetary savings, we're going to, you know, prevent 56 million pounds of CO2 from being emitted in 30 years. But what about the hope for a kid that has to listen every day about climate change on the news? And if you want to talk to kids about climate change, you got to talk to them about what their role is going to be. And it's a world they're going to inherit. An old bird like me, I'm not going to be around nearly as long as they are. They have to live with this. And so I think the ROI really is different for a 12-year-old kid than it is for a 60-year-old science teacher like me. It solar on schools would give them a great return on investment for money, for CO2, for dreams, for hope. And when you have this in your backyard, as we do, it becomes everyday life. It's not an alternative energy anymore. It's the energy of the future. So, is there any questions you guys have? Or
we'll turn to questions in just a minute. Thank you so much, Mr. Collins. But if you wouldn't mind just stating your name for the record as well.
My name is Patrick Collins. I teach seventh grade life science at Chisago Lakes Middle School.
Thank you so much. Representative Aiken, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, up next is Eric Passy from IPS Solar.
Mr. Passy, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Eric Passy. I'm the Chief Development Officer at Impact Power Solutions. We're a local solar development and construction company based in Roseville. And we're celebrating our 30th year this year, if you can believe it or not, a company surviving 30 years focusing specifically on solar. I've been here for 14 years, and I remember connecting with Patrick probably all the way back in 2008 on when they first started thinking about solar in Chisago Lakes. And it's tremendous to think about how far the district has come since then. We've taken a particular focus with schools, nearing about 50 installations for primarily public schools across the state, including Chisago School, St. Cloud School District, Red Wing Schools, and others. And we found that solar is a really great opportunity. It lowers energy costs for districts and local taxpayers and provides 21st century learning opportunities for students. IPS developed curriculum and hosts semi-annual educator workshops to bring those learning opportunities into the classroom. And this bill supports development by creating certainty for both districts and solar companies. And in our opinion, this bill would provide millions in savings for districts and local taxpayers by leveraging private capital and creating new public and private partnerships. I'm open to any questions that the committee may have, and I thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you so much. Representative Aiken, would you like to introduce your third testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Last to speak for the bill will be Andy Lesh from Minneapolis Public Schools.
Mr. Lesh, welcome to the committee.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to give you a quick overview of our Green Campus project at Edison High School in Minneapolis. Edison High School solar project included about 485 kilowatt hours of solar arrays on the roofs on two school buildings and a solar canopy adjacent to our athletic fields. The project was designed to save energy costs at Edison, but also be a hands-on laboratory. Edison's solar project was engineered and installed by Sundial Solar Energy with third-party financing C2 Energy. We also had a grant from Xcel Energy's RDF program. We completed it in 2019. The project was also won a National Award Smart Energy Decisions Innovation Award and was a finalist in an international award for Inner Solar Smart E Award. So the goals were to use the solar arrays as part of the Green Campus as teaching tools and in the classroom for instruction on related science, math, and engineering topics with integrated curriculum resources and lesson plans. Sundial also installed, we have like some of your other projects presented today, we had web-enabled monitoring system donated solar panels for use in the classrooms, and they provide technical support and interpretation of solar data, and also are assisting us in the supporting solar careers and energy careers. They also received an education grant from the Department of Commerce, provide home solar kits for the kids to take home and learn more about solar at home as well, which was useful in our current situation with kids out of school. So, and for many, this will be their first direct experience with solar electricity and how it's generated and can meet the needs for power while reducing the effects of climate change. And lastly, our site produces about 640,000 kilowatt hours of power. Represents about 42% of our annual usage at the school, and in summertime, 69% of our summer load when we air condition. So, based on 0.082 kilowatt hours, we save about $14,500.
I think you may have hit the mute button, Mr. Lesh.
I'm sorry.
Bet off at 14,000.
Oh, okay. So we're saving about $14,500 annually in electric costs, and over 10 years, we anticipate about $160,000 in energy, you know, in addition to all the educational benefits and other things at our green campus. So that's all I have. If you have any questions, I'm glad to answer those. Thanks.
Fantastic. And if you could just introduce yourself for the record as well.
Andy Lesh. I'm a project manager with Minneapolis Public Schools.
Thank you, Mr. Lesh. Representative Bacon, I believe those are your testifiers. So we'll turn to the two public comments that signed up, and then we can turn to member questions. So first we have Maddie Yapel. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Maddie Yapel. I'm in seventh grade, and I'm part of the Duluth Climate Club. I'm speaking with you today because I would like to share what my club and I have found out about how important solar is to our planet and how beneficial it could be to our schools. Here's a little information about the Duluth Climate Club. In 2019, a group of students from Ordean East Middle School in Duluth, Minnesota, started research on ways that we could help the climate. We learned about the solar in the school's legislation. We thought that it would be a great way to help our planet, so we got to work. For most of the school year, we met weekly, discussed how we would be able to make this goal for the school work. However, when the global pandemic struck, our club was no longer able to meet with the district leaders to discuss our research and solar goals. We then met again safely by Google Meeting. We were able to meet with Senator Jen McEwen, part of the Transportation Committee in Minnesota, and she also has a strong passion for the climate. She led us in a great direction and gave us a few tips on how we could support passing the solar in the school's legislation, which led us to a few days ago when the Duluth Climate Club wrote letters to our school board members, and several of them wrote testimony to this committee. Our research has led us to some very good possibilities for solar in the Duluth School District, having a few outstanding solar options, including Lincoln Park Middle School, which is located in the western part of Duluth. Lincoln Park is such a good option for solar panels due to the location's significant sun exposure. If solar is applied to Lincoln, it would house 4.4 megawatts of solar energy. For comparison, 1 megawatt of solar could power 150 to 210 homes. So 4.4 megawatts would provide a lot of solar energy to pay back to Minnesota Power, and would be a way we could make more money. Lincoln is one of multiple solar options we have in Duluth District. Thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of the Climate Club. Please take this information into consideration as you deliberate the solar in the school's bill.
Thank you so much, Ms. Yapel. And I don't think I knew what the legislature even was in seventh grade, let alone have the poise to present excellent testimony to a legislative committee. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Next, we have Tanya Jackson. Ms. Jackson, please introduce yourself for the committee and begin.
Yes. How amazing is Maddie? So Maddie is amazing, and I have 34 other students that are just as amazing and just as passionate in my climate club. So I'm so proud of you, Maddie. So hello, Chair Long, Representative Acomb, and other members of the Finance and Energy Policy Committee. My name is Tanya Jackson. I'm a teacher at Ordean East Middle School in Duluth. I'm also the advisor for the Duluth Climate Club. The Climate Club consists of an amazing group of young people in middle school and high school who want to make a positive impact on climate change. Climate Club came about 2 years ago when a group of students, after being in my science class and learning about climate change, said they wanted to do something to make an impact. We began meeting and brainstorming different things we could do to impact climate change. We started with small ideas like poster campaigns and education for our school community. However, these phenomenal students felt like those things were just too small. They wanted to do something big. They came up with the idea of getting solar panels installed at Ordean East Middle School. We worked with the energy coordinator and sustainability officer of the city of Duluth, college professors from UMD and a group of students at UMD. And we even got to meet with a delegation from Germany that worked with the Climate Smart Municipalities program in the state to do research and get more information. We decided that we wanted to put a solar array that would power our school gym. We would also install a monitor to put outside of the gym with a running record of carbon energy being saved to educate students and visitors to our school and the impact our small solar array would have in an effort to gain support for an even bigger one. Our idea was to finance the project through private fundraising and grant writing. We had presented the idea to our school board, facility manager, superintendent, and our chief financial officer. We were getting traction on the idea then, as with so many things in 2020, COVID hit and our project understandably got pushed off. Fast forward to the 2020-2021 school year, our climate club continued to try to find ways to make our project a reality. Because of the unique challenges that COVID presented in our district leadership, it became clear that we would need to find a new approach to getting our project off the ground. We began researching the solar on schools legislation, and this became our new focus. Prior to COVID hitting, a group of UMD students worked with our students as well as our district administration to complete a comprehensive solar plan for the district. Through their work, they found that Duluth District schools use about 9 million kilowatt hours of electricity per year. If all of the solar arrays recommended in the project are installed at Duluth schools, the solar arrays would offset 10.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. This would lead to an enormous savings for Duluth Public Schools. My climate students look at this data and scratch their head. And they say to me, Ms. Jackson, I don't understand. This is a no-brainer. Why wouldn't we want to do this? Our students see climate change impacting their world, and they are worried. Just as Mr. Collins so eloquently say, we have a responsibility to our students to show them that we are trying to fix the problems that are going to impact them the most. Our students are impatient and waiting for adults to make an impact. The solar on schools legislation will allow schools a path to put solar on their buildings. This would be a huge money saver in the not too distant future, but more importantly, it will signal to our students that we care about them and their future, and we are leading the way in making sure they have a future they can look forward to. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jackson. So that concludes our public testifiers, and so now we will go to member questions, and first up is Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I appreciate the testimony. Of course, I was on the school board for 16 years, my local public school board, and I certainly appreciate that. You know, this question is for the author of the bill, and I have a short summary here from our staff, and it says this bill would remove a requirement for utilities to pay for energy from third-party renewable providers at a specified price. Removing this provision would allow the Public Utilities Commission to set a higher price. This will result in higher electricity prices to the rest of the consumers. So, you know, I think one thing about the solar is, under the current scenario, we're pushing higher electricity rates to those who don't have it in the community. And many of them are on fixed incomes or low incomes. It also hurts our businesses and farms. And just appreciate Representative Akam's comments on that.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for the question. And what I'll say is that the details of the agreement between the power company and the details that are in this bill were set up in a bill that we were putting forward 2 years ago. And so, as I had said at the beginning of the hearing, I had hoped to include an amendment looking to be able to change and ensure that that's the agreement that still works. So part of the calculus that was brought into this is that there are renewable energy credits that come from implementing solar, and that has a value to the power companies. And so I think that I'm not certain that this will be the final formula that's put forward. You bring up a good question, and I think that we need to sit down, and I'm happy to continue to sit down and have conversations about what the final bill should look like.
Representative Hagan, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response, Representative Bacon. You know, I just want to speak to the students also. Please do research on the solar panels. They have a lot of environmental hazards. We're creating an environmental problems with these things. When a polar vortex comes down, we've had testimony that they don't work very little. In fact, back in 2019, when it got 30 below zero, only 4% of our electricity was being generated, according to Star Tribune article, by alternatives. So you have to understand that the savings you're seeing at your school are pushing cost and undependability of the grid to the rest of the consumers. And I've always said I'll support alternative energy when it provides baseload electricity and it brings the cost of electricity down. This bill and bills like it shift the cost of electricity, increase it, and make it more difficult for farms, businesses, and fixed income people to pay their electric bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say a couple words. First off, thank you to the author for bringing this bill forward. I've been looking for this bill the last session as well, and hopefully we can get it across the finish line here. In my community, there are folks who want to get this going on schools here as well. And so I just had a question for Mr. Collins. He had some work, I'm sure, in the community. He told us how that went and how they developed it, but I'm sure you had many naysayers who like to put up the roadblocks on why this isn't a good idea and why this can't work. And I just wondered how much of that you ran into in your process, because some of the advocates in this community are facing the same obstacles with people, and they just often ask, how much time should we spend in trying to convince people, or do we just move ahead with what's working elsewhere, what's the future, and get this working in our own communities? So if you could answer on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, we've basically had zero naysayers. The biggest issue we ran into was trying to convince a school board. We didn't want any money from the school. We just said, we'll raise the money. And they said, what if you don't raise it all? Then what happens? And we said, well, we'll put up a smaller system. But I think the issue is that I think solar and wind are proving to be cheaper forms of electricity by far. And then the other thing is we see impacts locally. I mean, Chisago City in our district, the next town over from Lindstrom here, they had to tear up all their sewers because they weren't able to handle the load of water going through. And what's that cost? And then to the disruption. So my question is, if we don't go to alternative energies, how much cost are we passing on to our other entities because of climate change? So the simple truth is we had basically zero naysayers. They were looking at it saying it's going to save us money. You know, it's not ugly because it's on the roof. No, we really didn't have any issues at all.
I was going to give you a follow-up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Collins. It sounds like a wonderful community to live in. So that's great. We do have, you know, some naysayers in the community. We have some naysayers, believe it or not, even at the Capitol. So, you know, we work with it all the time, and we're going to work through it, though, because I agree with you. There's so many other issues dealing with climate that are an advantage, in addition to the economics of it, as you've spoken so very well on. Only other question, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Ms. Maddie Yappel could do a bill for me today in Commerce at 3 o'clock. She was very polished.
Ms. Yappel, are you available at 3 p.m. to help out Representative Bierman?
Yes, I would.
Wonderful. Fabulous. Thank you. I'll get you the details.
Sounds great. I think it was a joke, so if you have class, that's okay. Representative Swadzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a general question. So do you have a cost on this bill? I didn't see from Representative Akam. And then what's your estimate? And then would you be open to, we're told that this will save school districts money. Would you be willing to write in the bill that if there are dollars saved, that it would come off the levy, local levies, to actually save local property tax or local property taxpayers' money?
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski for the question. And as far as how schools want to handle their savings, I really think we should leave it up to that local control. I think they have several choices on good ones, whether they want to invest into reducing class sizes or whatever their choices might be. Nothing is preventing them from doing exactly what you're saying. And so I think it's more appropriate to leave that decision up to local schools. And then I forgot about your other question. Sorry.
Costs, I think, fiscal impact.
Oh, yeah. So that's part of the, I'm not exactly sure. It's partially going to be maybe determined by targets that the committee gets. And certainly we have renewable development accounts that we can utilize, so I'm not exactly sure.
And we will be laying the bill over for further conversation. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a general question, how much will this affect the climate in Minnesota from a scientific standpoint? Will it lower the temperature? Will it increase the temperature? What will this particular bill do?
Representative Akam.
Thank you for the question. This bill is one tool that we need for all of us to be working together to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and lower the impacts of climate change. We're seeing what the climate is doing all around the country. We're hearing from people who are here testifying in support of the bill today, how important it is that we as a state work together to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And so it's just going to be one tool in the toolbox, but it's an important one. And one I hear from schools, certainly within my district, and when I'm talking to people in the community, it's a bill that they're familiar with and very supportive of. And so there you go.
Representative Swazinski, did you have a follow-up? Looks like not. Okay, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few things here. So to the educators that are participating in today's hearing, so I hear a lot about probably the benefits. I know there's a science teacher, Mr. Collins. You know, my kids, I've got two kids in public education. They've had to come, they've had homework dealing with green energy, which, everybody has different opinions. As one representative said, he called individuals that question naysayers in the community. I wouldn't say there's so much naysayers as science is never settled and science needs to be questioned and it's always evolving, right? It's never settled. But particularly with these assignments, that my kids and I know other students have had to tailor the assignments to the political belief in the agenda of the educators. So that's something to think about too. So the student wouldn't want to be considered a naysayer or a climate change denier, but instead saying, well, if I want an A, this is how I need to answer these questions instead of using their own investigative skills, I guess, for the assignment. So for example, let's talk about probably what's not being discussed in the classrooms
Education committee. So do you have a question to the bill?
Yep. So the raw materials being used, the rare earth minerals, are the students being told about the child labor that goes into making the solar panels, for example, in China, using Uyghur Muslims as slaves, or the human rights issues with children working in Congo to bring forward the raw earth materials to make electric car batteries, for example.
Now, these are very important topics to discuss as well, so that everybody can have a clear picture of exactly how dirty green energy truly is. It's definitely a human rights issue.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that I'm not sure if the question was directed toward me. I'm happy to answer it. I think that we certainly need to be looking at responsible sourcing of materials, and I think we need to do that throughout our supply chain. And that goes beyond just renewable energy products, but to our whole supply chain. And so I think that what the representative brings up is really important. And you know, I think human rights issues are at the core of who we are as a country, and we need to take account for that. And we need to make sure we're doing that throughout our supply chain.
Can I add a comment here?
Mr. Collins.
Yeah. When you deal with 12-year-olds, as I do every day in 37 years of doing this, they don't want to hear about negativities in the world. We try to go forward. So we don't deal with that part of it. And they don't get test questions based upon do you believe this or do you not, F or A. But what they do is we try to go forward and ask, you know, maybe what are the possibilities of this, and how is this going to work with electric cars and solar as far as charging your own car? We don't talk about asthma or flooding with fossil fuels. We just try to go forward and ask, why is this a good thing? You know, I mean, kind of like the utilities are doing. They're looking at this and they're going green because it's economically the way to go. So no, we don't focus on you know, partisanship and things like that. We just try to go forward. We tie it in with respiration and photosynthesis. We tie it in with native plants and sequestration. And so it's just part of our standards that we deal with. So there's no penalties for belief or disbelief.
Ms. Jackson, looked like you wanted to add as well.
Yeah, and thanks for the question, Representative Friends. And what I have had kids in my class that have questioned the validity of climate change, and I've always been willing to engage in that conversation. And I think that comes down to media literacy, which we really need to teach in our schools. And we're working really hard to make sure students understand reputable and non-reputable sources. So when kids come to me and say, Ms. Jackson, I don't believe in this, I say to them, okay, I'm gonna show you science and I want you to show me science, find it. Find me good science that demonstrates your point of view, and let's talk about it. And it's a conversation we have every year in class, and it is it does encourage kids to look at this from many different points of views and make their own decisions. And the other thing is one of the standards in sixth grade science is that every scientific advancement has a trade-off. And so there's no 100% good or 100% bad scientific advancement. There are trade-offs for it all. Now, human rights trade-offs are unacceptable, but some of the other trade-offs that come with solar panels, the benefits outweigh the trade-offs. And so we talk about that, not the human rights violations, but some of the others definitely do.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Representative Akam, would you like to make closing comments to your bill? And then we're going to move on to our next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the conversation today, and I hope I can count on your support for the bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Akam. The next bill is yours as well, and that is House File 1226. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Akam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1226.
Representative Akam moves that House File 1226 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Akam, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 1226. This is really a technical bill to remove some outdated language and to provide clarification on consistent pricing agreements for renewable energy generation. The existing language was intended to promote renewable energy systems, but now is having the opposite effect in some cases. And so I have some testifiers here to kind of help demonstrate the issue and to help understand the technical nature of the bill. And so with me today, I have David Schaefer, Executive Director of Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We'll turn it over to Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Schaefer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Long and members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee, my name is David Schaefer, and I represent the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, or MNSEIA. Our trade association comprises 115 solar-specific or solar-related businesses, which employ over 4,200 Minnesotans. I want to thank this committee for hearing this important bill, and to specifically thank Representative Acomb for carrying it. The bill seeks to correct a market irregularity. If passed, it will develop a fair space for renewable energy projects. Right now in Minnesota, if you want to do a project for any type of generation that is between 1 and 20 megawatts, the price you would get is something called avoided cost. I like to think of this as sort of like a wholesale cost. The bill corrects an issue we've seen in the real world, where there's tremendous confusion around how to calculate the wholesale or avoided cost when it pertains to renewable facilities. To step back for a moment, if you want to make your own fossil fuel burning facility, you have the option to get an avoided cost rate that is set by the Public Utilities Commission, that's negotiated with the utility company, or that is the price procured from a competitive bidding process. The language that we are amending today makes it so that it is clear that renewable energy facilities can also have those three options. Some of our state's utilities are interpreting the statute, so renewables can only receive the last option, or in some instances, an even more strict interpretation of the last option that pits 20 megawatt solar arrays in Minnesota against 200 plus megawatt wind farms in the Dakotas that haven't even been built yet. This is really an issue of fairness, and it allows renewable facilities to receive the same price offerings as non-renewable projects. The issue has already been litigated before the Public Utilities Commission. Dan Jewell, who you will hear from today, developed a wind-solar hybrid facility in Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. This language is used as justification to offer a lower avoided cost contract price than the project really deserved. After a multi-year battle, the PUC ultimately determined that the language did not apply. They found that they did, in fact, have the ability to set a rate, and that's what they did. So at this point, it did not seem like a legislative fix was required, since there was now precedent that this statutory language was not relevant. And we assumed that this dispute would be treated as case law in Minnesota. However, since that time, other utilities have pointed to the same piece of statute to offer similarly depressed prices. They are interpreting the language to be a mandate, not from any ill intentions, but because they seem to believe that is what they have to do under state law. From PUC filings I've read, it seems that they believe that they have to offer these depressed prices because this language remains in statute. They don't feel they can offer their standard avoided cost rates or negotiate with the developer as they would with a fossil fuel burning facility. So the solution is no longer with the PUC. You all have the ability to strike this unnecessary and confusing line from statute and to restore a fairer marketplace for low-cost renewable energy projects. Lastly, this bill is important because the current practice is having the opposite effect of its statutory intent. The language that's causing the confusion was created in the early 90s when renewables were much more expensive. The original bill author was the late Senator Janet Johnson, a pro-renewable Minnesota State Senator from District 18. Her goal with this language was to create pro-renewable legislation and an avoided cost project market. There's even a wind turbine dedicated in her honor. But now this same language she passed with the aim to create more renewable energy projects is being interpreted in a manner to squash the very projects she sought to bolster. It's important to modernize this statute and align it with the original legislative intent. So with those points made, I can conclude my testimony. I want to thank you all again for listening to MNSEIA's thoughts today and for your consideration of this provision for the Climate and Energy Omnibus Bill. And I want to thank Representative Acomb for bringing this bill forward. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Representative Acomb, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I would like to introduce Dan Jewell from Solar Bank LLC.
Mr. Jewell, welcome to the committee. Mr. Jewell, are you available?
I'm available now.
Okay, please proceed.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Chairman and Representative Acomb. My name is Dan Jewell. I am the CEO or former CEO of Jewell Energy, a longtime renewable energy developer in the state of Minnesota, 40 plus years. And I am presently the chairman of the board of Jewell Energy. And then I have a little company called Solar Bank, which I deal with battery storage technology mainly. I've been asked to come and talk about the project that we put together for the city of Red Lake Falls. We started that project in 2015 as a basically a template model for us to look at how we can produce clean, sustainable energy in the state of Minnesota at low cost. And so we put together a package with General Electric that included two 2.5 megawatt wind turbines, or 2 megawatt class wind turbines, and 1 megawatt of solar, and put it in together into a package to make it work. When we approached Otter Tail Power Company on the power contract based on the federal law of avoided cost, we had trouble, shall I say. And so we were forced, after quite a while, about a year of trying to negotiate, to go to the commission and try to get them to look at what is the avoided cost. And that's when we ran into the statute language that we are looking at today at changing, that basically said that the, and even the department wanted to compare this project with a project in North Dakota that had yet to be built and yet to be online, but they wanted to use that low cost that was estimated by the utility to be the benchmark for this project. And there's a huge difference in the value chain. When you look at the hybrid project that's involved in Red Lake Falls, that's online today, we produce commercial scale power using wind and solar as a hybrid system, and we deliver the power directly to the load. There's no fuel, no emissions, no waste, no water consumed, and no transmission costs. And you can't compare that to a project out in the middle of North Dakota that basically has to deliver that power through hundreds of miles of wires and dozens of transformers to get to the power to where it's consumed. And so there's a much higher value chain. And also, we as Minnesotans need to look at how can we keep our energy dollars and create economic development in our state and not build big wind farms in North Dakota, pay for the big wires to bring it into Minnesota, and we still keep paying. And so the whole idea with this hybrid was that. And, you know, the avoided cost discussion is a very good discussion. And we know we can produce power cheaper. We know we can deliver it cheaper. We just have to be able to put that on the table. And just to give you a quick economic example of this.
If it could be quick, Mr. Jewell, because we do have some public testifiers as well.
Okay, I'm sorry. If this project was on my co-op, I live on a co-op, we could deliver the power for 4.5 cents. My co-op gets charged 7.5 from its G&T in North Dakota. We would save 3 cents a kilowatt hour on 20 million kilowatt hours. That would save my community, my co-op, $600,000 a year. That's the economics of this.
Thank you so much, Mr. Jewell. Representative Bacon, would you like to introduce your final testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Last, we have Reed Richardson with U.S. Solar.
Mr. Richardson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Akam, and members of the committee. My name is Reed Richardson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of U.S. Solar. I grew up in Plymouth, Minnesota, graduated from the University of Minnesota, and spent about 9 years developing solar projects out in California before relocating back home in 2014. U.S. Solar is a developer, owner, and operator based in Minnesota, operating out of the historic Butler Square building downtown Minneapolis next to Target Center and Target Field. We employ about 30 people in Minnesota. We've provided jobs for dozens of contractors who in turn employ dozens of staff, and we pay rent to dozens of farmers and dozens of communities. We've completed over 70 individual megawatt plus projects in Minnesota, and now we're exporting our project development, finance, and construction to other states around the Midwest and the country, in addition to contributing to policymaking using our best practices that we've learned here. Having a true calculated full avoided cost price based on an approved methodology will provide the certainty that's necessary and establishes that ability to rely on a reasonable value-based price. To reiterate previous comments, 10 megawatts of distributed interconnected solar is not the same as 300 megawatts of transmission interconnected wind that may or may not get constructed and financed. It's just not an accurate proxy, and we shouldn't need to use that type of proxy project in order to calculate the avoided cost. Distributed generation of solar perhaps coupled with batteries or other technologies, can reduce line losses, improve reliability and resiliency, and may defer other expensive utility investments. Further, the current statute has created an unpredictable pricing that doesn't support the solar project development and finance. We and other firms like ours would love to develop projects in that 1 to 10 megawatt space, which is in between the rooftop and net metering and community solar projects and the large utility scale projects. And we can do so at these cheaper rates. But the value that we would bring to the grid is not equal to the lowest bid price from an unrelated project at a different scale. So in conclusion, having this reasonable cost methodology for calculating avoided cost will provide the needed certainty for solar project developers to establish a marketplace for competitively priced distributed solar development that spreads the benefit around to more stakeholders while still being priced at or below the utility's true avoided cost of energy and capacity procurement. Thank you for your time, and I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Richardson. We have four public testifiers who are signed up, and then we'll go to member questions. If we'll keep folks to 2 minutes each so we have time to get through our agenda today. First, we'll begin with Mr. Underdahl.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power. At first, I'd like to recognize we appreciate our partnership with U.S. Solar and Mr. Richardson on our Renshaw 1 megawatt community solar garden project, and also our partnership on a project of solar and storage in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. So I appreciate using local workers and local developers. And as has been shared with this committee many times, Minnesota Power supports a carbon-free system and are moving towards that end, but while ensuring reliability, affordability, and safety remain at the center of our transition. We certainly recognize that all forms of energy play a role in this transition, but it's also essential that appropriate policies are in place to ensure we are optimizing and providing for an efficient and cost-effective energy supply. The voided cost statute that this bill contemplates amending is an example of a policy that was created to balance these considerations that look to support participation by qualifying facilities while also maintaining consumer protections for customers required to purchase the energy and capacity from these projects. Both are important, and striking the right balance is also incredibly important. In its current form, we do have some concerns that this proposal could result in an outcome that loses this balance on what certainly is a technical and complex topic. We hope to have continued discussion with the bill author and proponents on this bill as it moves forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Next, we will hear from Benjamin Stafford. Mr. Stafford.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Stafford. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. We are an industry-led nonprofit representing the business voice of clean energy in Minnesota. We work to educate Minnesotans about the economic benefits of transitioning to a clean energy economy. Our membership consists of over 40 clean energy companies, ranging from startup businesses to Fortune 100 and 500 companies that employ thousands of Minnesotans across the state, and we're here to support the bill. I'll skip some of the technical testimony, which I could definitely wade into and talk to in more detail, and sounds like that'll continue. But the clean energy business community supports this bill that modifies policy and market barriers which impact clean energy options. The proposed modification does just that. It creates some certainty and modifies an outdated framework that serves as a barrier, and this modification creates a more even playing field for clean energy resources. These investments in clean energy resources are a down payment on good jobs for Minnesotans. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, Minnesota was home to over 61,000 clean energy jobs, including nearly 5,000 in solar energy. And where you have more energy or investment certainty, you have more job growth. These jobs were growing at 2.5 times faster than all other sectors of the economy, according to our 2020 jobs plus report. You know, and lastly, and just on the demand side, you know, more access to clean energy options is better for business in Minnesota. Our businesses know that climate risk is business risk, and a movement toward low carbon and carbon-free economies means lowering that business risk. Businesses know that their investors, customers, employees, and stakeholders expect them to have sustainable operations and have sustainable energy options. Market-based and modern frameworks that move in this direction show that Minnesota is open for business. So I'll stand by sort of there for testimony, but want to provide some support for this bill.
Thank you. Next up is Joe Hoppe. Mr. Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Joe Hoppe with Otter Tail Power.
As I've testified in the past in your committee, Otter Tail Power supports the goal of clean, reliable, and affordable energy for our customers. In this bill, the language that the author proposes to remove is important to utilities for ensuring that we don't pay more than market prices for renewable energy that we source for our customers. The Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act of 1978 at the federal level required that utilities must buy power from independent generators. Later revisions to this law define the purchase price to be avoided cost. In other words, the price we would have to pay in the marketplace or the price we paid in our last acquisition of such a resource. While we are willing to work with the chair and the proponents of this legislation, at Otter Tail, we do think that the current statute has done a good job of protecting consumers, and we would urge the committee to leave it in place as it currently exists. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And last, we will hear from Rick Evans. Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. House File 1226 deals with a situation where a certain size of energy generator is producing energy and selling it back onto the grid. Under the federal purpose statute, as Mr. Hoppe just mentioned, those facilities, which are called qualifying facilities in federal law and state law, are entitled to sell their energy to the local utility. In other words, this is energy that we are required to buy. It's not a market transaction. There are three things to keep in mind about this transaction. First, the energy that's produced in these circumstances is not needed by utility customers. It doesn't go through resource planning or a certificate of need or any of those processes. Second, the cost of this energy is passed through directly to our customers. Xcel Energy does not have an impact on its bottom line with this transaction. It is a dollar-for-dollar payment by our customers. And the third thing is that the price paid by utility customers is essentially a subsidy for the developers of this energy. This bill changes the price that our customers will have to pay for the energy. Current law fixes the price our customers have to pay at the lowest level that those customers would pay for comparable renewable energy. Current law does not force self-generators to accept a price for dissimilar resources like coal or gas or nuclear, but it does limit the price to the lowest cost for renewable energy. That way, the owner of the qualifying facility is able to sell energy. It doesn't go to waste, but our customers are protected from higher prices that they would pay for comparable energy. Current law is a fair and reasonable balance between the interests of the few entities that would build these facilities and the bulk of our customers who essentially have to pay for it. I would like to remind the committee that the single biggest impediment to Xcel Energy's drive toward eliminating carbon emissions is concern about cost. This bill raises the cost of energy to our customers, and we would hope that the committee would consider this as it considers this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Next, we'll turn to member questions. I have one quick question for Mr. Schaefer. I'm wondering if, Mr. Schaefer, you could respond to the question of whether or not an avoided cost rate is a fair rate or a subsidized rate.
Thank you, Representative Long. So avoided cost, the purpose of it, is to find the price that the utility would otherwise pay for that type of energy. So it shouldn't raise any rates on anyone. If you're doing avoided costs correctly, it's the fair market price that they would receive from something else. So maybe the best way to think about it is if a 10 megawatt facility went online, that's 10 megawatts worth of coal or natural gas that the utility doesn't have to buy as fuel to burn in the future. And all we're seeking is to be treated the exact same as qualifying facilities that aren't renewable. So those particular facilities could exist. They do exist. And they are getting an avoided cost price that's higher than renewable facilities. Because, in my opinion, the utilities are incented to push back on this particular provision because it means less competition for them.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. We have three questions and 5 minutes until we have to move to our next bill. So if we can try to be succinct, Representative Swazinski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to just make a comment first, and then I've got a question. I mean, in all due respect, I think the solar development that's happening in the state and around the state is not necessarily replacing coal or gas. It's replacing other cheaper means of solar production. I mean, if you look at the 800 megawatts of community solar that's been developed without a resource plan that is forced upon ratepayers, to me, this bill is essentially a tax increase without actually raising taxes. It's going to potentially raise rates because it doesn't offset coal. It offsets other solar cheaper development. And, you know, with a question like that, will these my first question is, the developers currently putting projects on the ground, are they currently making money at the current rates? And will this bill just make them more money? That's my question.
Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Representative Swierczynski. So when this item was effectively litigated at the Public Utilities Commission, the administrative law judge found that if this interpretation was to be applied forever, then no one would ever be able to do any projects of this type. So no one is making money doing this. No one really can do this unless they want to do what Mr. Jewell did and basically file a year-long dispute, well, two-year-long dispute at the PUC to try to get a fair avoided cost price.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question's probably for Rick Evans, maybe Thor as well, but just kind of curious, do we need more generation? Do we have a deficit now? Is there a need for incentives for solar? It seems like this is just driving up the price of solar energy that's being available.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bull, you know, well, first of all, we don't have a need for energy. We are long on energy in Minnesota. It's in the Xcel energy system. We don't need this energy. It is energy that comes onto our system. It's not planned for. It's not the subject of certificate of need. It doesn't go through any PUC process that says this is the best way to go. Energy that we get from this does in fact reduce the amount of solar energy that we would buy at a lower price. What we're trying to do is provide low cost, clean, renewable energy to our customers at the lowest possible price. And this change essentially works against that goal.
Representative Botta, do you have a quick follow-up? Looks like not.
I did not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So my first question, I guess, would be to any of the utilities that would like to answer. So, and I heard Mr. Evans say that it would increase the cost to the consumers. So I'm actually wondering how much do the customers pay annually for this type of energy already? And approximately how much would that that cost increase? I know that it will increase, but can we have more of a visual?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I don't have a precise answer to your question. I'll see if I can get one and I'll share it with the committee. What I would say is that, you know, the reason this part of the law is a problem is because solar energy and wind energy is becoming so inexpensive. That's a good problem to have. And all that this provision that would be stricken in this bill does is require that when someone brings solar energy onto the system, that they do it at a cost equal to what we would pay for the lowest cost renewable clean energy that we can get. That is in the best interest of our customers. This cost passes directly through to our customers, and we're trying to get them the benefit of the falling cost of wind and solar, and we think this provision helps us do that.
Representative Franzen, did you have a follow-up?
Yes. My next question is, and I guess anybody that can answer it, Mr. Chair, would federal law allow us to peg the price for this renewable energy to the lowest cost to purchase any energy?
Who would like to take that question? Mr. Schaefer?
Representative Franzen, so I question whether this particular provision is even legal at the federal level. So the way it is currently, I'm not sure that a least cost bid approach like this for all facilities is legal, but, you know, I guess that would be better than the current status quo. At least there'd be equality. However, I think that the avoided cost methodology really holds ratepayers harmless, and so it doesn't seem necessary to depress the price of all competing sources of energy together.
Mr. Underdahl, and then we're going to need to move on to our next bill.
Yeah, I apologize. I'll be very quick. I would just say on one thing, you know, full avoided cost of other, you know, particularly gas is what's usually compared to, considers all those attributes, the firmness that come along with that as well, too. And I would also point folks for, if you want to get really nerdy, FERC order 2222 that just came out and MISO is contemplating does look at DERs and how they should be and would be valued within the wholesale markets and the system from the distribution level. So there's a lot of things in the work to help support those as well too. So good for the committee to understand that.
Representative Akam, did you have any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, just thank you to the testifiers and the comments, the conversation that we've had today. Appreciate that. And I would just ask members' support in laying over House File, what is it, 1226.
Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 1226 be laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we are going to hear from Representative Christensen on her bill for solar for state parks. Representative Christensen, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I presented this bill last year, so I'm looking forward to reintroducing it this year. It now has a bill number, which is HF 1423. So the Solar and Parks Bill is proposing a $2 million appropriation from the RDA fund to install solar devices in state parks within the Xcel service area. Funding, like I said, will come from the RDA account. So thanks to the superior reliability, also as was stated just earlier in our last conversation, the low cost of solar power, solar panels offer a cost-efficient way to produce clean and renewable energy in our state parks. America's national parks are eagerly, you know, taking this on, and I hope that Minnesota can follow suit. Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers that can testify to the bill today. I should also mention this is going to be laid over. So, you know, we can have future conversations on this also. So do you want me to introduce the testifiers, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Okay. So my first testifier is Peter Teglund from Minnesota SEIA, and he will speak to the bill. Thanks.
Mr. Teglund, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long, and Representative Christensen, and representatives of the committee. My name is Peter Teglund, and I am the Policy Associate for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, or MNSEIA. We represent 115 different solar companies or solar-related businesses. Those companies employ over 4,200 Minnesotans across the state. I'm here today on behalf of our members to voice our support for this bill. Minnesota's state parks are a wonderful shared resource for all of us to enjoy our state's natural beauty. And solar is a great fit for powering our state parks. It's a great fit for creating energy savings several times over the cost of the initial investment. Here, the savings can be reinvested in staff and maintenance instead of electric bills. The flexibility this bill affords to the DNR means that park solar installations can go where they're most needed, whether on the grid or off. On-site generation like solar is typically most valuable in places that are hard to reach with power lines, whether that's in outer space or in the back corner of a Minnesota state park. Lastly, I would like to add that this bill will create some fantastic educational opportunities at the visitor centers and in other public buildings in these beautiful settings. I'd like to thank the committee for your time and to Representative Christensen for bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Teglund. Representative Christensen, would you like to introduce your last testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce Phil Leversedge from the DNR.
Mr. Leversedge, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Glad I have just a few more minutes today than I had at the last hearing. So I'm Phil Leversedge. I'm the Deputy Director for the DNR Division of Parks and Trails. I'd like to thank Representative Christensen and the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of her bill that would provide funding to invest in solar power for state parks. There are 10 state parks located in the XL service area covered by this bill, and they're primarily in the St. Croix River Valley, kind of the near Twin Cities metro, and a few parks south of the metro area, and then a couple in southwest Minnesota. And I've got a list of those if you're interested. But in these 10 parks, we currently have 6 small solar systems that generate about 100 kilowatts of energy, providing about 20% of the electricity needs for those parks. Initially, we put them in through grants through the renewable development account and using our Parks and Trails legacy funds. And we did it twofold. One is to reduce our energy costs and carbon footprint, but then also as an educational tool to expose people to solar energy and the benefits and challenges around solar energy. And increasingly, we're recognizing that it's really great for us for reducing our long-term operational costs. Like I said, we're saving over 20% of our ongoing operation costs in those parks. We estimate it would take about 5 times the current capacity to meet all of our electrical energy needs in those 10 parks. And based on our current estimates, it would be about a $2.5 million investment in solar to provide 100% of the current energy needs in the 10 parks. Other testifiers today have done a great job explaining the values of renewable energy and the needs to address climate change. And I won't even try to compete with people like Ms. Yappel, who so eloquently talked about the benefits for young people of addressing climate change. But I'd like to offer that we'd be interested in working with the author and the committee to support and improve the bill. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Leversedge. Looks like we do have questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question would be to the DNR, Phil Leversedge. Edge, I think I said that correctly. Are you open, you know, if you've got spots in the St. Croix Valley parks that you're looking to potentially electrify with this, what is precluding you from just inviting community solar gardens onto the state park property? Would you be open to that?
Mr. Leversedge.
Yeah, Representative Swazinski and Mr. Chair, we'd be open to conversations. I think one of the challenges, and you bring up the St. Croix River Valley, one of the challenges is proper siting of the solar. Certain areas are more conducive to providing, you know, solar on a small scale, and others might be more conducive on a large scale. For instance, Interstate State Park in a rocky gorge on the St. Croix River is really difficult to provide any large scale solar. And of course, as far as large scale community solar gardens, our concern would be that at that scale, it might have some negative impacts on the other resource values that we're trying to protect in those parks. So it's proper sizing for the location would be our biggest concern.
Mr. Chair, what are those other resource things you're trying to protect? What, just for people that don't really understand what you're talking about, what are you talking about?
Mr. Sure.
Thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair. So state parks are set aside to preserve the outstanding natural and cultural resources of the state and the aesthetic resources of the state. So it's a balance of trying to preserve natural areas such as native prairies or you know, in the case of wooded parks, the natural woodlands and the natural resource species, and then the cultural resources of those areas. So that would be some of the consideration that we'd have to look into as far as proper siting of any solar applications.
Representative Swazinski, briefly, we've got two more members.
Thank you. And just one last question. Appreciate your time, Mr. Leverage. Would you consider the solar gardens, solar farms have a negative impact on certain species with proximity to, you know, lands and state parks and those other uses?
Mr. Leversedge.
Mr. Swazinski, Representative Swazinski and Mr. Chair, I wouldn't have the science to say that there are negative impacts from the solar, but we can certainly line up some biologists that could answer that question for you.
So Mr. Chair, I would look forward to that. Let's have that conversation. Let's line up those scientists. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Zinske. So we just have time for one question each, Representative Branson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, I believe it's Representative Christensen. So I am wondering if you can diagram the flow of money from Xcel ratepayers to these solar installers. Curious to see how much they would benefit through this piece of legislation at the expense of the Xcel ratepayers.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the question, Representative Franson. I will honestly say that no, right now I couldn't diagram the flow, but I will say that we're going to be laying this bill over, and that, you know, I can certainly work with Xcel Energy and try to get you that information, get the information for the committee.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So will this in effect become a moneymaker with money power being sold onto the grid, or will it create power just to be used in the parks? And will these parks be just in Xcel service districts or kind of all over the state? Thank you.
Representative Christensen, would you like to take that?
Yeah, I can take part of it. So I should have mentioned that I'm also going to request from the general fund that we get matching funds that will address state parks outside of the Xcel area. So I should have mentioned that earlier. And what was the second part of your question, Rep. Bowe?
Will they be consuming that power that's generated in the park within the park for consumption of the power, or will it be sold off onto the grids?
Maybe Mr. Leversedge can answer that.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to Mr. Leversedge.
Representative Bowe, Mr. Chair, our current solar systems are attached to the grid for the most part. There may be a couple instances where we have isolated situations where we are off grid that we have some solar, but generally our systems are connected to the grid.
Thank you, Mr. Leversedge. Thank you, Representative Christensen, for presenting your bill. Our next bill up is Representative Athena Hollins of PV Demand Credit. Representative Hollins, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am here to present a really straightforward common sense bill that was brought to me by Mencia and the Minnesota Commercial Solar Installers and the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. The bill is, it asks Minnesota Power and Otter Tail Power to submit a methodology for reimbursing demand customers with PV systems greater than 40 kilowatts for demand charge overbilling that occurs. So basically, when a commercial solar array is installed, the customer's overall demand is reduced. They need less power, and that's especially during the utility's peak period because they're producing more power of their own on site. However, customers are often billed as if their demand is still the same, thus overbilling their customers. Xcel Energy has put into place a methodology to compensate their commercial demand, metered customers with a PV demand credit rider. This isn't an incentive program like solar rewards. This is a right sizes charge. I understand that not all investor-owned utilities are the same. Customer bases and peak usage times do vary, and therefore the language in the bill does not demand for Minnesota Power and Otter Tail to reimburse at the same rates as Xcel Energy, simply that they must examine the issue and submit a plan to the PUC. To date, the Minnesota Power and Otter Tail have been required to participate in the PV demand credit rider docket, but have yet to adopt a mechanism to compensate their customers and have more or less avoided participation in the debate. And that is why this bill is before you. I do have a couple of testifiers. I'd like to introduce David Schaefer, again, reintroduce with Mencia, who can provide more detail on the bill's language.
Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hollins, thank you. Chair Long and members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee, my name is David Schaefer and I represent Mencia. I want to thank this committee for hearing this bill and to specifically thank Representative Hollins for carrying it. Today we are here in support of the extension of the photovoltaic demand credit rider to Minnesota Power and Otter Tail's service territories. This rider, which exists in Xcel's energy service territory already, was created to mitigate an issue of unfairness. When a commercial demand metered customer puts up a solar array, their overall demand on the system is lessened. They need to procure less power during the utility's peak period because they are producing more of their power on site. However, these customers are often still billed the same demand charge. They are treated as if their demand remains the same. This isn't anybody's fault. It has to do with how the demand has been measured by utilities for decades. When you take this old approach to measuring demand and pair it with a new technology like solar, it results in utilities overbilling their commercial customers. Xcel's PV demand credit rider reimburses their customers for the overbilling that occurs. They use something called the capacity value stack methodology, which is referenced in this bill. This methodology finds that the true overbilling is and says how much Xcel needs to reimburse their customer. Xcel's approach illustrates that customers are on average overbilled on their demand by about 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour through the course of the day, or more specifically, they are overbilled about 7 cents per kilowatt hour between the hours of 1 and 7 p.m. The bill that is before this committee today recognizes that this overbilling not only occurs in Xcel's service territory, but likely also occurs with all other investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota. All this bill seeks to do is to have the Public Utilities Commission rectifying any overbilling that may occur to commercial industrial customers in Otter Tail Power and Minnesota Power service territories. It's important to note, too, that the capacity value stack methodology would not produce a recrediting amount if the overbilling did not occur, since there's a subtractor in the methodology for any time the demand charge is reduced coincidentally with the utility's peak. So if Otter Tail and Minnesota Power do not believe an overbilling occurs, they would have the opportunity to prove it at the commission. One of the options on the table for determining the overbilling is Xcel's capacity value stack methodology, but the other utilities are free to provide alternative approaches to handle the issue too. Furthermore, Xcel's PV demand credit rider is not an incentive. It is removing a market barrier for commercial customers to go solar because it ensures that the utility is not overcharging their solar customers. By removing this barrier to entry, we have seen a solid rise in commercial projects in Xcel's service territory. Initial data indicates that in the first year of the program alone, about 50 customers opted to go forward with their commercial solar project, which resulted in about 15 megawatts of generation. And that is all great for Xcel's service territory and the commercial customers within it, but we're not seeing much in the way of commercial industrial adoption in Otter Tail or Minnesota Power service territory, and we surmise it is because of this overbilling issue. Once this correction to the free market is made, we believe the commercial solar in those territories will be financially viable. So with that, I'll say thank you to Representative Hollins for bringing this bill forward. Thank you all for hearing my testimony, and we urge the inclusion of this bill into the Energy Omnibus Bill and ultimate passage into law, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hollins, would you like to introduce your last testifier?
Yes, my last testifier is Adam Seidel from the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum.
Mr. Seidel, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Representative Hollins and Chair Long and members. I am Adam Seidel, Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum, and I'm here today to express MNCEF support for the PV Demand Credit Rider Bill. We support this bill because it represents a step forward for Minnesota's market competitiveness for commercial customers, represents an opportunity to generate savings for all ratepayers, and encourages private investments outside of existing subsidized solar programs. We're also proud to be part of a bill with Representative Hollins' authorship in the House and bipartisan authorship across both of the two bodies. Overbilling has already been discussed here a bit, so I'm going to condense my comments to that for time, but ultimately the demand charge purpose is to recognize the reality that electricity is most expensive to produce at the peak times when demand is highest, and the demand charge exists to partially compensate for this for high demand customers. So any strategy that reduces power use at peak times eliminates the need to generate this most expensive power, saving all customers of a utility money. Solar tends to generate the most power during these peak demand times, creating savings for all customers. By overbilling private investors, we're discouraging activity that is not only profitable for those families and businesses, but also creates savings for all ratepayers. This is price transparency in energy. MNCEF recognizes the need as well for utilities and customers to make decisions on a local basis. And this bill acknowledges that all three of Minnesota's investor-owned utilities are distinct from one another and empowers each utility to work with the PUC to create a structure that makes the most sense for their respective local customers. And many of those customers, by the way, helped create this credit in the first place. They worked collaboratively with Excel and the Department of Commerce to modify the existing credit methodology and to refine it over the last decade or so. So companies like Target, IKEA, LifeSource Organ Eye and Tissue Donation, Midwest Diesel Services, as well as government institutions like the University of Minnesota, the City of Minneapolis, and the Met Council, all supported and worked for this credit at the PUC since the inception, all the way back in the 2010 rate case and as recently as the 2017 docket on this issue. So this bill represents a step forward for private and unsubsidized commercial solar investment. It's important to note that in the Excel Territory program, community solar gardens or solar projects subsidized under the Solar Reward Program are ineligible to participate in the demand credit rider. So this bill allows these private market solutions to receive greater focus as part of Minnesota's overall solar marketplace strategy. The impacted utilities, their customers, and the PUC have been discussing these issues formally for a number of years, but there currently has been no resolution or active dockets on the topic. We believe the time is right now to move forward and stop discouraging private investment. And last, as a conservative organization, we appreciate the opportunity for the legislature to weigh in and set the policy priorities for the state of Minnesota and allow the regulatory system to return to managing the technical details under the direction of our elected representatives. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins and members, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel. We have two public comment signups. First, we're going to hear from Mr. Underdahl.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and comment on this proposal. First, I'd just like to state that Minnesota Power is very different than Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy serves 3.1 million residential customers. We serve 145,000 residential customers. So I'll describe some of the way our solar has supported all levels of solar energy, but the numbers might not be as exciting as you'll hear from Xcel Energy. So just want to caveat that. Minnesota Power was the first investor-owned utility to have a solar rebate program. SolarSense started in 2004. Since that time, we have rebated over 370 customer-sited solar installations, totaling more than 3.3 megawatts of solar. We were the first utility in the state to offer a dedicated low-income solar program in 2017, and of the over 8 megawatts of customer-sited solar in our service territory, nearly 50% is made up of larger systems, 40 kilowatts to 1 megawatt, the exact issue that this bill seeks to address. We've also introduced a community solar garden program in our service territory, which uses locally made, which currently serves 80 Minnesota Power customers. And we have a proposal for 20 megawatts of solar that would be located in our service territory, which would be made using locally manufactured solar panels to the benefit of local jobs and the economy. I just want to address something real quick. It was referenced that we did not engage with a PV demand credit docket. There was no PV demand credit docket. The docket being referred to is docket 15-155. It was a standby rider docket. I spent a lot of time reading it over the last 4 days since this bill came out. It's a very interesting record. I would encourage folks to dive into it. That specific docket was contemplating our standby rider, which specifically had no solar customers on it at the time, so it was not contemplated for that end. It is true that in a discussion with Xcel Energy, who did have solar on their standby rider, different advocates brought forth the idea of a solar capacity credit. It was also contemplated on whether or not other rate-regulated utilities should consider this option. The Department of Commerce supported not moving forward with this, and the commission did not order Minnesota Power nor Otter Tail Power or Dakota Electric, who was involved in that docket, to move forward at that time. We made comments in that docket that we fully support this conversation in any number of germane dockets relative to solar. So with that, we would support moving forward with this and working with proponents to use existing regulatory channels to get towards this end. We think this conversation can absolutely happen without predefining the time, type, and timing of methodologies and technology considerations. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're hearing from Mr. Hoppe. Mr. Hoppe.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, as I said earlier, Otter Tail Power supports clean, safe, reliable, and affordable energy. We support solar and all renewable energies, and we have been talking to and will continue to talk to the proponents of this legislation. I'd like to offer three quick comments on it. Otter Tail isn't convinced that this proposed legislation provides an appropriate mix of incentives and costs to serve solar customers. Otter Tail believes its current rate designs provide appropriate incentive levels and strong price signals to encourage use of renewables and conservation. And Otter Tail hasn't had any complaints from customers who are installing or utilizing solar or other renewables. As I said, we support solar, we support renewables. We're happy to continue the discussions on this legislation or other legislation like this. And that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hoppe. And we do have one member question, and we'll just have to limit it to the one question since we're at time. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a general question when it comes to just bills that we're hearing. We still have amendments that are kind of posted to your 100% non-baseload energy bill. Are we going to be taking those up at any time, or kind of what's the plan with that?
Thank you for the question, Representative Swazinski. We're not going to move any bill out of the committee without giving everyone an opportunity to amend the bills. We do have a full slate of bills to get through before deadline, so we're working hard to do that at the moment.
As we're hearing the bills, though, we're kind of doing these informational hearings. Will we have opportunities to amend bills and before we actually get to the final markup for the omnibus bill?
Representative Swazinski, as I mentioned in a previous hearing, we're doing our absolute best to get the bills to us in time for the hearings. We came just short on two bills today, but we got one in time for us today. With the reviser backup, it's been a real challenge to get bills before us, but no bill will move out of the committee before it has an opportunity for amendment. Members, we are out of time. We have a joint hearing that the notice will be going out soon with the Senate Energy Committee this Friday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. And the topic will be the increase in gas prices that we saw over the last couple of weeks and the impact that those may have on Minnesota ratepayers and options for Minnesota's utilities. So it will be a unique joint hearing with the Senate, but it's an important topic. There's a Public Utilities Commission hearing on the same topic this afternoon, and we want to give members an opportunity to learn more about the rate impacts and ask questions. And with that, our remote meeting is adjourned.